listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Ghost in the Machine by Mark Rosso. The Williams approach, as Kramer noted, is exceedingly rare these days. As the Hollywood composer I spoke with put it, the name brands have had people write their music for 20-plus years. A veteran Hollywood music supervisor described how it works. The composers have 6 or 7 projects on the go at any point, he said, referring to lead composers working in television. The leader sets the tonal palette to get them going, and then the minions do the actual writing. Let's say you're one of these minions, an additional composer or a studio assistant who is allowed to write, and you're working on the score of a tentpole movie with a major film music studio. You're assigned a number of cues, bits of the score that you will compose to accompany specific scenes. The lead composer, whose name will go on the final product, has worked up the overall direction. Zimmer calls it the sketch. As Devo founder turned film composer Mark Mothersbaugh, Rugrats, The Lego Movie, and 4 Wes Anderson films once described it, you give them themes, you do a rough mock-up, and then those people fine-tune it all. In some ways, it's a system that resembles the assembly line studios of contemporary artists, such as Mark Kostabi and Jeff Koons. As a fine-tuner, you write the actual music for your assigned cues and submit demos to the lead composer studio. Then comes a process of feedback and approval, followed by the actual recording, which could mean an orchestra. To put film scoring into culinary terms, the cues you've written go into a soup, the score, created by many fellow sous chefs, additional composers, working under an executive chef, the lead composer. Part of the idiosyncratic beauty of a Hollywood film score, as the Hollywood composer I spoke to phrased it, is its cool collaborative aspect, a handed-down-the-line feel. When the team clicks, there is a shared sense of energy and enterprise. For many young composers, it's what draws them to Hollywood as opposed to Carnegie Hall. If their contributions end up being credited, usually as additional composer, and the pay is decent, the participants can be quite happy. They can pay the rent. They might someday rise to the level of lead composer, as did John Powell, Henry Gregson Williams, and Lorne Balfe. Brilliant film scorers all, coming out of Zimmer's behemoth remote control studio in Santa Monica. The minions there are sometimes referred to as Zimlings. And then there are the ghost composers. As much as ghost composing is virtually unknown among the movie-going public, it enjoys a long tradition as an entry-level rite of passage. One of the gods of film scoring, Ennio Morricone, was a ghost composer before earning his first credit on a feature in 1961. I've been a ghost myself on really big movies, Zimmer has noted. Occasionally, the issue of ghost composing pops up in the media, as when, in 2014, the deaf Japanese composer Mamoru Samuraguchi, a so-called digital age Beethoven, was found to have employed a ghost composer for 18 years. It was regarded as a scandal. On the message boards of VI Control, an online composer community, the conversion inevitably veers toward ghost composing. When I saw the composer's site with his reel populated by the stuff I did 100% on it, I wanted to puke out of shame for that person, a poster called Audio Loco wrote last year. Another poster alluded to big-name composers accepting industry awards for music they didn't write. Ghost and additional composers speak of moments of almost comical awkwardness, as when a director, reviewing the score, marvels at a beautiful passage and exclaims to the name-brand guy who did not, in fact, write it, "Oh, we're so lucky to have you." The awkwardness is compounded when the actual unacknowledged composer is sitting in the room. It's part of the frustration that Ghost and additional composers feel. The world has no clue what they do. "You're not just arranging," the Hollywood composer said. "You're writing." The issue of payment can cause frustration, too. The composer on the Emmy Award-winning series told me that he got $150 up front per cue, the length of which can vary. He might spend as many as 10 hours on each one. "When you break it down, it's like minimum wage," he said. The fee for a cue can also fluctuate greatly. Depending on the project and the lead composer, one ghostwriter on big movies mentioned getting $1,500 per minute of music. When it comes to royalties, the veteran Hollywood music person told me, the standard split with the lead composer is 50-50 per cue, even if the additional or ghost composer does all the work. After all, the lead composer is putting a roof over everybody's head. In certain studios, if the lead composer does anything on the cue, suggest that the tambourine be lowered in the mix, for instance. The lead composer's share can increase to 75%, and if the cue comes back from the studio, network, or streamer with a note, a requested change, then the lead composer can take 100%. It is thought that this motivates the minions to deliver flawless cues. 2 years ago, Nadia Wheaton, a composer and music production coordinator, posted a soul-bearing account on her website of her frustrations as an aspiring Hollywood film scorer. Despite some notable successes, she found herself making painful budget decisions, such as whether to spend money on gas or on food. She wrote about the specter of homelessness and about studio assistants being paid $12 an hour with no overtime. "It felt like some of our idols were just there to exploit new talent," she wrote. Wheaton ultimately left Hollywood and turned her focus toward video game music. "A lot of people have come out of that system feeling that they were abused and not wanting to do it anymore," the composer Carter Burwell told me when I went to see him at his home studio on Long Island's East End. "But then some people come out, hang up their own shingle, and become a successful film composer. So it's a sink or a swim situation." Burwell, who was 67, has a sage-like aura. He graduated from Harvard and was playing in downtown Manhattan post-punk bands when Joel and Ethan Coen asked him to score their 1984 film Blood Simple. He has since been nominated for Oscars, Golden Globes, and BAFTAs, and has won a Primetime Emmy for his work, which has ranged from the infernal yodels of Raising Arizona to the somber tones of Fargo. "The day I visited, he was working in his studio, a low-key, go-it-alone operation, far removed from, say, Zimmer's remote control, which boasts an army of studio assistants and collaborators." Burwell built the studio inside a modernist house, drenched with sunlight, and set amid a dramatic dunescape with forever views of the Atlantic. "I would not have been able to buy this house if it weren't for the performance royalties for Twilight," he told me. "It's as simple as that." He said that Your Music, Your Future was established to remind young composers that they need not give up their royalties. ASCAP President Paul Williams, The Grammy and Oscar-winning songwriter who gave us the Muppet Movie's eternally wistful anthem, The Rainbow Connection, emphasized the you-never-know-ness of working as a composer. The Love Boat, we thought it wasn't going to last 4 weeks, he told me, and it went on for 11 years. It is those hits that really helped pay the bills, and I am very happy I never gave up my ongoing royalties. The royalty system goes back to 1914, when the composer Victor Herbert, having sued a restaurant for using his music without permission, won a Supreme Court decision entitling him to ongoing payments. Herbert then went on to co-found the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, ASCAP. It was very highly structured, and it made a predictable business model, Burwell said. For most composers, the rule of thumb is that the upfront fee paid by a studio or streamer goes into the production. It covers your time, any studio fees, and the musicians you hire. The back-end royalties, which you receive in exchange for forking over your copyright, represent your income, the steady drip that can continue for years. According to music law experts Todd and Jeff Brabeck, a composer can earn more than $200,000 over the course of 5 years from a typical film, and considerably more from a box office hit. Half the income that the composer used to get comes from royalties, the Hollywood composer told me, and now streaming is throwing that way off balance. The open letter to the PROs said that streaming releases ultimately pay just 5 to 10%, as much as comparably budgeted theatrical projects. Netflix presents itself as a tech company, not an entertainment company, Burwell said, echoing a broadly held sentiment. They don't feel obliged to follow the norms of the entertainment industry at all. According to Nielsen, which last year began reporting improved streaming ratings numbers, American viewers opt for streaming offerings on television about a third of the time, a percentage that is growing exponentially. Last fall, when the New York Times asked Zimmer if he was worried about streaming cutting into his studio's revenue, he responded tartly, "I stopped being worried about it because it's already happened." Last October, Netflix sent three of its music executives to the Society of Composers and Lyricists annual meeting held online. "We're trying to find the best way to pay composers," Amy Dunning, Netflix's vice president of music, creative, and production, told the group. The executives suggested that the problem of distributing royalties lay with the PROs, and said that composers who don't want to take buyouts can simply reject that clause when negotiating their contracts, something many early career composers are understandably hesitant to do. The buyout model was described as a work in progress that would evolve as Netflix continues to navigate the innovation curve. Such talk sounds odd coming from a company whose 2020 revenue reportedly clocked in at $24.9 billion. It's well past the shaky startup phase. According to a veteran Los Angeles music lawyer who specializes in digital, the streamers pay 1% of their total revenue to ASCAP, BMI, and other PROs. Netflix declined to make their executives available for comment in this story. Composers understandably see their work as having contributed to the streamers' remarkable success and believe they should benefit from it. When I talked to Chris Bowers, the 32-year-old Juilliard-trained jazz pianist and producer who scored the Netflix mega-hit Bridgerton, he said, "We're not having a conversation about actors not getting back-end. Our music is a representation of ourselves, even if it's not actually us on that screen." With back-end royalties dwindling or cut out of the equation entirely, there's a growing feeling of disgruntlement in the vast community of additional and ghost composers who fuel the Hollywood music studios. Zimmer's remote control studio is perhaps the most cited avatar of the hyper-collaborative system that has taken root in blockbuster-focused Hollywood as deadlines tighten, pressures mount, and digital editing forces scorers to aim moving targets. Scenes can be tweaked ad infinitum before reaching picture lock. A website devoted to Zimmer credits the many collaborators who make up the remote control team. There are 66 composers, 74 co-composers, 28 arrangers, 72 additional arrangers, and 23 credited with additional music. 16 more people in various capacities round out the list, bringing the total to 279. If Zimmer can't get a cue right, one composer told me, he has 60 people behind him willing to give it a shot. Zimmer is arguably Hollywood's top film scorer, a visionary innovator who once played keyboards in The Buggles and who happens to be extremely intelligent and ultra-charming. He is a regular presence on VI Control, where he is also the number one topic. Is he overrated? Is he a genius? Does he actually compose? It's almost like he's a sound designer with notes, one poster said. Zimmer, who is 64, is probably best known for that epic Brahm, an unforgettable sonic rumble that became so imitated that Zimmer himself professed to be tired of it. In 2013, after Zimmer did an interview with Vulture about Inception, a ghost composer named Mike Zarin came forward to claim that he was, in fact, the author of Brahm, venting his frustration to IndieWire. Seeing someone on the inside, who knows exactly how everything happened, outright lying, that bothered me. Zimmer declined to speak for this story. Zimmer is sometimes asked to address the issue of authorship. I make them partners in the project, he said of his team last fall, when Dune was released. I try to give them credit. For him, cinema is a communal experience, and so is creating the music for it. I try to be fair, he has said, but sometimes it's just not possible. There are complications involving the run time of end credits, the maddening bureaucracy of cue sheets. One composer I spoke with said that the perception in the industry is that Zimmer is doing better with giving credit than he had been in the past. ASCAP award-winning composer Deborah Lurie, who wrote the luminous score of the 2010 film Dear John and has worked as an arranger with Katy Perry, confirmed that credit can be complicated. But for her, collaboration is not the issue. I think that the issue is honesty, is secrets. Gifted with perfect pitch and impeccable chops, Lurie began her career more than two decades ago, working with the ubiquitous Danny Elfman, Batman, Men in Black, 50 Shades of Grey, whom she described as one of the good guys in the business, hands-on with his music, that is, he works closely with his additional composers. In the conversations I had, certain composers tended to come up in this good guy category, such as Motherspa, who is generous and assiduous about sharing credit, and Powell, who is known for boosting assistants up the ladder. She soon became one of the most successful women composers in Hollywood, a field that is perhaps needless to say dominated by men. In 2020, the Grammy-nominated pianist and composer Nomi Abadi founded the Female Composer Safety League, an organization dedicated to the empowerment of women working in the industry. As one music executive told The Hollywood Reporter last year, sexual harassment in composing is pretty widespread. When I spoke with Lurie, she referred to what she called the paradigm, meaning the golden image of what a Hollywood composer is. Lurie had always aspired to this ideal, Mancini, Williams, and their ilk, but found her old-school go-it-alone ethos increasingly difficult to sustain in streaming-era Hollywood. Here I was, a bleeding-heart, totally emotional artist who just thought about the movie 24/7, she said. She didn't want to be a brand or a figurehead or be told, as she was, to just phone it in. A couple of years ago, Lurie decided to take a breather from the business. She argues that transparency is what's needed, a Hollywood music culture that can emerge from the shadows and be frank about what it is. I'm not trying to turn back the clock, Lurie insisted. I'm trying to figure out how to make things proudly be what they are. In such a world, star composers would be open about the fact that they are delegators. Ghost composers would get credit. Assistants wouldn't feel hopeless, and everyone would be fairly compensated. More than three decades ago, Mancini noted, with the new technology that keeps entering the media, film composers are constantly being placed in new learning situations. There is, admittedly, a bit of plus a change to it all. Yet, Lurie articulated what many in the composing community say among themselves. There was a business that I loved, and I thought it was my life, and now, as things changed, not so much. Even so, there's hope that things will improve. Happy endings, after all, are what Hollywood is about. Some of the change will come from the inside. As Joe Kramer vowed on Twitter last year, throwing a challenge to his fellow composers, I promise not to hire an assistant who is really a ghostwriter. Zimmer has admitted, I think we need to be fairer. Speaking to the financial side, so disrupted by streaming, the Hollywood composer told me, in 10 years, the market will figure out how this works. Focusing on the artistic side, Lurie, who keeps getting calls to compose music for Hollywood and has been considering getting back into the game, struck a similar chord of optimism. I want to believe that there's still a demand for artists that live and breathe one project at a time, the kind of projects that require human musicians and things that essentially only humans can do, she said. If there's still a love for that, if people want to leave a movie humming the theme, there has to be a business model that reemerges. And I have a vision that there will be a new interest in that ultra-human, painstaking kind of music work again. Otherwise, as the Hollywood composer said, waiting in his home studio for the next gig, how are composers going to survive? Now here's a Vanity Fair spotlight, Truth and Beauty by Cassie DaCosta, with photograph by Peter Hapak, showing Ruth Negga in profile. On screen and stage, Ruth Negga plays tenacious, complicated, and riveting women. Ruth Negga is a woman of words. Both on screen and on stage, she's explored characters with an attention so piercing that it's almost literary. "I was lucky enough to have the foundation of training," she says. Fortunately, the Irish-Ethiopian actor's education wasn't shrouded in the typical elitism of the drama conservatories. "I did it under the umbrella of a university, Trinity College, Dublin, and that meant I didn't have to pay extortionate fees." That access was crucial for Negga, who wasn't ready to hustle for sponsorship at the time, a practice often common for working-class students at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and Juilliard. To put it mildly, she's made the most of her degree. This year, Negga has been picking up critics' awards, thanks to her turn in Rebecca Hall's directorial debut, Passing, in which she plays Claire Kendry, a lively but mercurial black woman passing for white in 1920s New York. Claire is married to an overt racist, played by Alexander Skarsgård, and she only begins to reconnect with black society after running into her old friend Irene, Tessa Thompson, who herself passes occasionally for the sake of convenience. "I grew up in a lot of different places, and I think people are sort of confused by my heritage, because for a long time it was considered unique and exotic," Negga says. When Claire talks in a wistful manner about wanting to be with Negroes again, to hear them laugh, it makes me feel sort of uncomfortable, because it's like she's exoticizing her own self and her community. And is that what Passing does to someone? Negga has played a variety of characters over the years. Ophelia in a National Theatre production of Hamlet, Welsh singer Shirley Bassey in the TV movie Shirley, a Mars-dwelling operations director in the Brad Pitt sci-fi film Ad Astra. What links them all, she says, is their fortitude. In 2017, Negga received an Oscar nomination for Best Actress for her role in Loving, in which she played Mildred Loving, the real-life defendant in the Supreme Court case that ended miscegenation laws in the U.S. "Mildred had the same sort of tenacity I'm drawn to in other women," she says, "because they're not just one thing. You can be vulnerable and tenacious. You can be cantankerous and a contrarian and tenacious. You can be an extrovert and tenacious. I'm more interested in how we contain, hold, and deal with our multitudes, but the contradictory nature of all those multitudes." When she's digging for the truth of her characters, Negga always circles back to the text. In the case of Passing, that meant returning to the novel of the same name by the Harlem Renaissance writer Nella Larsen to grapple with the fact that living as a white woman has altered Claire in ways that are hard to quantify. "Is that a good thing or a bad thing?" says Negga, who's about to appear in Macbeth on Broadway alongside Daniel Craig. "Do we condone that? Condemn that?" The interesting thing I keep coming back to with the novel is that she does neither. Everything is up for grabs in terms of ambiguity, really. That means the responsibility is on the reader or the recipient or the viewer. You must do the work, because it challenges you on where you stand, how you interpret something. And that's quite difficult for some people, Because sometimes we do like to have something neatly packed and delivered to us so we can grab it easily and say, oh, this is wrong or right. And Nella really evades that neatness beautifully. Event Cascade by Anthony Bresnahan. In late October, cinematographer Helena Hutchins was tragically killed when a hot gun went off on the set of Alec Baldwin's movie Rust. Five errors led to a catastrophe that's shaken the film industry and sent the district attorney on a quest to find answers. Opening photo shows an aerial shot of the movie set for Rust. Mary Carmack Altwies raced across the desert, chasing some peace and quiet. She had won her campaign to become Santa Fe's district attorney the year before, and her first 10 months in office were intense and all-consuming. In her previous life as a public defender and later working in private practice, she always internalized her cases. She felt that empathy made her a good attorney, but it was depleting. I've spent basically my entire career working the worst of the worst cases, and so I feel it a lot, she says. In October, her prosecution had successfully sent a man to prison for his role in the child abuse death of a 13-year-old boy. It was a gruesome, emotional case, and Carmack Altwies needed to decompress. So she scheduled some vacation time, and on the afternoon of October 21st, started a solo trip to Taos, New Mexico, a small town known for its historic Pueblo dwellings, art galleries, and majestic views of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. I was going to just spend the night up there and have a nice, relaxing evening off, she says. Her wife and kids would join her the next day for her birthday weekend. But first, she needed some alone time. There's a spot in between Santa Fe and Taos for 30 to 45 minutes where you lose cell service entirely. I'm driving along, and all of a sudden I come back into cell service. And my phone just started dinging. I was getting text messages, and it was just like ding, 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 ding. The district attorney stopped on the shoulder of the road. The first text was, "There's been a potential homicide on a movie set." I started scrolling through, and it was people from my office saying Alec Baldwin has shot two people. Truly, I was like, what? This cannot be right. The basic details of what happened on the set of Rust are well known. A gun held by Baldwin during a scene rehearsal on the Bonanza Creek Ranch went off, firing an actual bullet through cinematographer Helena Hutchins' upper body and into writer-director Joel Souza's shoulder. Souza was wounded but survived. Hutchins did not. Witnesses and sheriff's documents describe her bleeding on the floor of the church set, panicked and baffled. The accounts of her suffering are excruciating. Despite all we now know, crucial questions persist. Chief among them are, how did this happen, and who was actually responsible? The answers won't be clear-cut. This is a case in which Baldwin, the person holding the gun, may not be directly to blame for Hutchins' death. Still, even if he had never touched the weapon, he is one of the many producers on a film now under suspicion for recklessness and disregard. As D.A. Carmack Altwies must determine whether the errors involved rise to the level of criminality. Her work began on the side of that road in New Mexico with a flurry of text replies and calls. I turned around and came back, she says. I assigned one of my chief deputies to basically embed with the sheriff's department to help with any warrants they needed, any legal questions. And then I spoke to the major who was initially in charge, going back and forth on some different investigatory tools that they could use. We were basically all hands on deck. Carmack Altwies' first priority as a prosecutor was to ensure that any evidence the sheriff's office uncovered remained admissible in court. I'm sure we drove them crazy, because it was four lawyers reviewing a search warrant, and each one of us had, oh, you need to add this, and oh, I wouldn't put this in. Carmack Altwies will never meet Hutchins, but they had much in common. They were both 42, and both were embarking on new, higher-level challenges in their work. Both were married, both were mothers. Helena had a son that is my son's age, and just thinking about my son and that little boy being without a mom was really upsetting, says the district attorney. So I definitely hugged him too much that weekend, and then I came into work on Monday, and we started talking about strategy and what we needed to do to make sure that this case was treated with the utmost professionalism and respect that it deserved, that all homicide victims deserve. Hutchins Union, Local Cinematographers Guild 600, has compiled tributes from friends and colleagues who remember her as someone who loved to joke and dance, but was also a relentless fighter for her work and an ever-replenishing source of energy. Even the cinematographer's website biography has a droll, self-effacing touch. Originally from Ukraine, Helena grew up on a Soviet military base in the Arctic Circle, surrounded by reindeer and nuclear submarines. The day after her death, Hutchins' husband, Matt, posted a photo of her with their son hiking along a creek. Helena inspired us all with her passion and vision, and her legacy is too meaningful to encapsulate in words, he wrote. Our loss is enormous. Hutchins studied journalism at Kyiv National University and began her film career working on documentaries in Europe. She then devoted her focus to cinematography, graduating from the American Film Institute in 2015 and made splashes at Cannes in 2017 with the sultry thriller Snowbound, and at South by Southwest in 2019 with the Fright Fest Darlin'. American Cinematographer magazine named Hutchins one of its rising stars in 2019, and she was fulfilling that promise. Rust was supposed to be the next step in her life, not the end of it. In late February, the DA's office expects to receive a forensics report from the FBI's crime lab that they hope will reveal critical details about the live round of ammunition that killed Hutchins, including, possibly, who physically handled it, placing the deadly object in an environment where it never should have been. And the listener should remember that this magazine went to press before that time. Santa Fe Sheriff Aiden Mendoza said at a press conference in October that about 500 cartridges had been recovered from the set. That is a mix of blanks, dummy rounds, and what we are suspecting are live rounds, he said. Dummies are inert props that only look like bullets, loosely filled with tiny BBs so they rattle like maracas. Blanks are brass casings loaded with explosive powder to create a bang and smoke, but have no projectile to launch. Live rounds, by contrast, are lethal and have no place in make-believe. They shouldn't have been there, Mendoza told reporters. Next photo. Tragic consequences. The Ukrainian-born cinematographer, wife, and mother, Helena Hutchins, worked on more than 30 projects before starting Rust. While the district attorney hasn't yet filed charges and won't know for several more months if she will, Carmack Altwies already sees that Hutchins' death was caused not by a single action but by numerous failures and mistakes. The cinematographer, mother, and wife was killed by an event cascade, each event contributing to the moment that claimed her life. Virtually no one involved is willing to admit to any culpability, especially as the threat of prosecution looms. Baldwin has said he feels grief over what happened, but not guilt. Assistant Director Dave Halls, whose job involves enforcing safety, and, according to the sheriff's investigation, announced that the weapon in question was a cold gun, also doesn't believe he is responsible, according to his attorney. Representatives of Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the novice armorer who prepped the weapon, insist she did her best on a poorly run production. Only one person publicly regrets his actions, and he wasn't even on the set. One, the hiring of the armorer. Neil W. Zoromsky saw the warning signs. It's why the longtime Hollywood prop master did not accept the lead position on Rust, one of several people who reportedly turned it down, even though he loved the script and thought it might be a level up for him that would lead to even more opportunities. I thought it would challenge me. I never mastered a Western, says Zoromsky, whose 30-year list of credits includes long runs on the shows Criminal Minds and Scandal. Rust unit production manager Roe Walters first emailed Zoromsky about the job on September 20th. Zoromsky's enthusiasm for the project grew as he read Sousa's screenplay to assess what it would require in terms of props and weaponry. He described being transfixed by the story of Baldwin's character, an outlaw named Harlan Rust, who is trying to save the life of his young grandson, who, in a tragically ironic twist, shot and killed someone by accident. But Zeromsky's confidence in the project began to wane. First, the production lowballed him, he says, but he was willing to accept a lesser fee because he believed in the project. Then he realized they were rushing things. On September 23rd, Walters emailed him again. "We are still very much in need of a prop master, ASAP. Give me a shout back." The next day, she informed him of the schedule. He would have to be prepped and ready in Santa Fe by October 5th, and they hadn't even begun formalizing a contract. "These folks started talking to me roughly 10 days before they were going to begin shooting," Zeromsky says. "And that's a disservice, not only to the department and what the department is responsible for, but it's a disservice to the film and a disservice to the actors that are working on the film." He still wanted to make it work. "I was really pretty much ready to sign the deal in spite of all the warts," he says. Then he learned he would have two prop assistants, but no separate armorer to focus exclusively on the film's array of firearms. "We'd really like one of the assistants to be the armorer that can push up on the gunfights and heavy armorer days," Walters emailed him the next day. She did not respond to request for comment. This was the deal breaker, when they wanted to compress the responsibilities of these two positions, Zeromsky says. "This would definitely create a dangerous situation, with safety being minimized." He cited his own armorer credentials as the industry standard. "I have to maintain an entertainment firearms permit, and I've maintained that for about 10 years, he says. "I also maintain a federal firearms license, which puts your fingerprints with the FBI and with Interpol." "You can't imagine yourself an armorer if you have a bunch of skeet shooting trophies on your shelf." As lead prop master, he would have insisted on overseeing a full-time armorer with that level of experience and dedication. Since he wouldn't be getting it, he turned down the job. That position, as well as the separate armorer assistant job, both eventually went to relative newcomers. Zeromsky doesn't feel like he was spared from being part of a catastrophe. Instead, he's overcome by grief, because he thinks he could have prevented it. The newbie who took the armorer job was Hannah Gutierrez Reed, daughter of Thel Reed, a legendary Old West armorer and gunslinging advisor for movies such as Tombstone, L.A. Confidential, and Django Unchained. She told the Voices of the West podcast in September that due to her father's storied career, she'd been around firearms her whole life and occasionally worked for him as a production assistant. But when she was hired on Rust, the 24-year-old had only one previous credit, the as-yet-unreleased Nicolas Cage Western, The Old Way. "It was also my first time being head armorer," she said on the podcast. "I was really nervous about it at first, and I almost didn't take the job because I wasn't sure if I was ready." Zeromsky was working on a Super Bowl commercial with LeBron James when he heard the news of the shooting. "I think the sound mixer had a radio on or something, and I felt sick to my stomach," he says. "He went to the bathroom and threw up." Next photo, twist of fate. "I might have killed myself if I thought I was responsible," Alec Baldwin has said. And in this photo, he's shown speaking on a cell phone. 2. The introduction of the bullet. How did the bullet end up in the gun? That's the source of significant rumor and innuendo. It's also the subject of a new lawsuit between the armorer and an Albuquerque props supplier. Immediately after the shooting, reports suggested members of the crew were putting real bullets into the prop guns and shooting at bottles and cans during downtime. Carmack Altwies says investigators are exploring that possibility to rule it out. "I have not heard anything yet that actually occurred." She also dismisses the notion proposed by attorneys for Gutierrez-Reed that disgruntled crew members may have deliberately mixed live rounds with dummies. Rust did have labor problems, with some camera operators walking off the set the morning before the shooting because they were, in part, unhappy with the long work days and wanted housing accommodations nearer to the remote set. But would an angry crew member really try to get revenge in such a potentially deadly way? The notion that they're sabotage, I mean, there's not one iota of evidence at this point, Carmack Altwee says. But somehow, a real bullet made its way to that set. Investigators have both the casing and the slug recovered from Sousa's shoulder. Carmack Altwee's hopes the upcoming FBI lab report on those materials will help resolve the chain of custody. But on November 30th, a new search warrant affidavit filed by the Sheriff's Department indicated that detectives were looking into the Albuquerque office of PDQ Arm and Prop and its proprietor, Seth Kinney, who provided materials for the film's weapons. Sarah Zachary, also 24, and a relative newcomer with just 2 credits, ended up taking the lead prop master job Zaromsky and others turned down. After the shooting, Zachary rushed back to the weapons cart and examined the box of dummy bullets that she believed assistant prop master Gutierrez-Reed used to fill the cylinder of the gun. As Zachary checked the dummies in the box, she found some of the cartridges would rattle, according to the sheriff's search warrant request. In other words, there was no explosive packed inside them, just BBs. However, others did not rattle. Sarah said this led her to believe some of the other rounds in that box were live ammo. But who brought the box? Zachary told investigators she believed the ammunition for Rust was provided from various sources, including Kinney, Gutierrez-Reed herself, and another individual identified only as Billy Ray. On October 27th, while detectives executed a search warrant on the prop truck at the Bonanza Creek Ranch, Kinney was there to provide the code for unlocking a safe, and Detective Alexandria Hancock used this as a chance to question him about what items he provided for the film. Seth advised the ammo included dummy rounds and blanks, the November 30th search warrant stated. He said how the ammunition he provides to the productions are from a manufacturer identified as Starline Brass. The suspected live round that killed Hutchins had a Starline Brass logo on it, the document added. But Starline Brass doesn't sell blanks, dummies, or live rounds. It only sells brass casings and other elements that can be used to assemble those things. On October 29th, Hancock reported she received a phone call from Seth, where he advised he might know where the live rounds came from. He did not admit to supplying the bullet himself, but told her he had experience with Starline and the live round in question was probably reloaded ammunition, a handcrafted bullet, rather than one pre-manufactured by another ammo company. That still didn't resolve who made the live bullet or who brought it to set. On November 17th, Gutierrez-Reed's father, Thel, directed investigators toward Kinney. He told Hancock that he had previously worked with Kinney in August and September on another movie production. They held a gun range training session with those actors away from the set to give them a sense of how real guns feel when they are fired. Thel Reed told investigators that Kinney asked him to bring an extra canister of live ammunition so they wouldn't run out. Thel stated, "This ammunition was not factory-made rounds," the search warrant declares. In other words, they were homemade. And Starline Brass supplies the materials for such things. After the training session, Thel Reed said Kinney kept that extra canister. Those rounds, we believe, were the ones that ended up on the set, says Jason Bowles, an attorney for Gutierrez Reed. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.